The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
It is Wednesday, December 29th, 2021. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report, and this is the best of Majority Report 2021.
Rockin'.
Ladies and gentlemen, here with Emma Vigeland, we are looking back on the year 2021, playing some of our best shows. It's odd the way that Christmas and New Year's fell this year. So it's like usually we end up having to do like 7 or 8 of these shows, right, Matt? But this year we only did 6.
Because Christmas is on the weekend and yeah. New Year's.
Yeah, yeah. Weird.
That's unfortunate for people who like don't get days off.
You guys got screwed.
But no, I mean, you're okay. No, we have the whole week off. We're not in when this is airing.
Oh, we're not here. Meanwhile, I'm in the midst of the longest vacation I've had in 11 years.
No, my point is just a lot of people only get 24th and 25th off, and then that Friday ends.
Right. It's just the weekend. Yeah, that sucks.
That sucks.
Anyways, on the program today, part of our best of cavalcade, Haiti, neocolonialism, and the Moïse assassination with Pascal Robert. He is one of the co-hosts of This Is Revolution. It is a great podcast. We just ran an interview that we did with Jason Miles, his co-host, yesterday.
I was on there now a few weeks ago, and I think you were on there before. Yeah, I was on there talking about, well, sports, but and politics around sports as well, because I think they're going to be delving into a new sports area.
Whoa.
This Is Revolution.
They're
specifically Jason, I think.
Very, very smart guys. And you know, one of the things that I learned from Michael Brooks was just how much our history in this country is intertwined with Haiti's. It is a more dramatic relationship, I think, than a lot of like imperialist countries to another country, or at least to the other countries that we have sort of
in terms of the degree that our imperialism has
shaped them, but shaped also them. How much they shaped us. Like their revolution is really why we, you know, have Louisiana. Like the Louisiana Purchase was a function of the really the only, you know, major slave revolt. Most successful slave revolt. All of this is wrapped up, and there is, it's, I don't know, to the extent that you could have a psyche for a country, we still seem to resent that. Because the funny part is that, A, we got the Louisiana Purchase because of it, because Napoleon was hurting.
Needed the funds.
Needed the cash. But it also was something that we were very concerned about, because you don't want that example out there, that precedent of like, wait a second, slaves can do what?
Yeah.
Yeah, if it was all about the ideas, you would have think the Americans would be like, oh, good, another republic to join us. This is going to be fun.
Right.
But that's not quite exactly what it was about. It wasn't about those ideas, really.
It wasn't so much about spreading freedom. It was more like small f freedom.
I like how your initial Reuben kind of had like a Spanish accent to it, Matt.
Yeah. Well, he's
going to Miami soon, so we're going to Florida. Yeah.
I'm putting on a little bit of Creole.
Amy.
Yeah. I'm doing Spanish Creole. Check that out. You're going to enjoy this interview. And then tomorrow on the program, we continue with our best of 2021 interview with Congresswoman Ilhan Omar, who you may or may not know is the congresswoman from Minnesota. She is also the whip of the Progressive Caucus.
Yeah.
And, you know, subsequent to this, we found out there was a big falling out between Pramila Jayapal and Nancy Pelosi. And in many respects, I don't know. I think there may have been, at this point, it looks like, a mistake in passing that bipartisan infrastructure bill. After all,
Ilhan Omar voted against it.
This is, I think we did this interview in like what, the month before that happened, right? Or just
October,
leading up to it?
October.
All right. So, but that's tomorrow.
That's tomorrow.
Right. Sorry. So here is Pascal Robert on Haiti. All right. Want to welcome back to the program Pascal Robert. He's the co-host of This Is Revolution. He is a contributor to the Black Agenda Report, as well as Washington Spectator and HuffPost. Pascal is joining us right now from, I believe, Florida. Pascal, thanks for joining us again.
Thank you for having me again, Sam. How are you today?
I'm doing well. I'm here with Emma Vigeland.
Hey, Pascal.
Hey, Emma, how are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Doing okay. Is my audio working all right?
Your audio is working great. And wanted to talk to you about a couple of things that are in the news these days. First off, there's been an assassination, obviously, in Haiti.
You heard about that?
I did hear about that. In fact, we reported on the other day. Moise, am I pronouncing his name?
Moise.
Okay.
By the way, Moise is the French name for Moses.
Okay. So Moise was assassinated. Just do us a favor. Will you just go back and give us some very remedial information? Because, you know, people, I think, I mean, I learned this, frankly, from Michael Brooks and the interviews that he did years ago. But prior to that, there was virtually, I never heard any history, not in school, not in the context of why we have had such ongoing involvement in Haiti. Will you talk just briefly about the Haitian independence and the implications that really Haiti has represented for a century and a half at least in this country?
So you're asking me to basically sum up 200 plus years of history in a short conversation. I think I can do that.
No pressure.
I knew you could. That's why I asked.
Basically, to understand the situation relative to Haiti is to put Haiti's revolutionary independence struggle that started in 1791 in the context of its proximity to the U.S. history. When the Haitian Revolution started in 1791, George Washington was president of the United States. So we have to understand in relativity to these two factors that the importance of Haiti to the development of the United States in the 19th century and even after its initial founding was very, very important, because prior to Haiti's independence, the Republic was called Saint-Domingue under the auspices and control of the French. The colony was actually more valuable to the French than all 13 colonies were of value to the British, because the trade in sugar, particularly sugar, coffee, tobacco, but particularly sugar and rum, made it one of, if not the most valuable colonies in the slave plantation system that existed in the Western Hemisphere. So one of the things you have to understand as well is that, contrary to in the consciousness of a lot of people who look at slavery in the American context as being so brutal, so horrible, the French plantation system in Haiti was absolutely egregious. If any of you, I'm sure you guys have read Black Jacobins, which is a book I have some issues with for various problems. They used to do things like bury slaves in sand and put molasses on their head and have maggots and ants eat at their face. They would put gunpowder in the anal orifices of Africans who were rebellious to literally have them explode. The type of tortures that the French would engage in with the Africans on the plantation was absolutely brutal beyond words, so much so that the average life expectancy of an African slave who was brought to the island as a young adult or an adult will be no more than 5 to 7 years. So in other words, you bring an 18-year-old African slave to Haiti, at best, he's going to live to maybe, 25, 26, and he's going to die. And one of the reasons why the French did not care about that is if you read actually French writings, they would say things like, the shores of Africa are always generous. They basically believed that they could just keep coming in and importing and importing and importing more and more Africans. And if they died like flies, it didn't make a difference. That was fine. So much so that several of the other colonies, because of the rebellious nature of these Africans on these plantations, were a little bit leery of importing such large numbers, which did affect some of the United States at a certain point in terms of its attitude towards importing Africans. So what basically happens is that in 1791, a group of mostly African slaves have a ceremony that is known by Haitian, ceremony Bwakaima, where they basically created a united front religiously. Some of them were animists or voodooists. Some of them were Muslim. And they basically came together and decided to unify their various religious diversity that they would have had on the African continent in a kind of spiritual pact to join together to fight the French plantation owners. So they started, after they had that ceremony, a week later, they started savagely just burning and killing European plantation or French plantation owners by the hundreds. They killed like a couple of thousand within a week. So this violence starts to expand and expand and expand. And it's basically just guerrilla warfare. And what happens is that because the island was so valuable, the French have competitors in this exploit. Don't forget, the other half of the island, which is now the Dominican Republic, is controlled by the Spanish. The Spanish, seeing that the French are basically going through chaos, and this is also proximate to the French Revolution, are saying, "Yo, listen, we can come in here and we can actually say we're going to promise these Africans that we're going to free them, and we can fight the French, get them out of here, and we can like free some of them and actually still have some slavery for others who are a lower class, and you know, this can work out for us." So what happens is the Spaniards come into the island and they actually start to train some of the more high level slaves like Toussaint Louverture and others as soldiers officially in the Spanish army to fight against the French to maintain control of the island, because the Spanish are like, this is a lot of money here, man. We're gonna keep this. And what happens is that, now understand something, even though the French were brutal plantation owners, all of the Africans, the blacks, and the mulattoes, what you would call biracials, were more culturally in affinity to the French. They spoke Creole or French. Their culture was, even though there was obviously an African dominant culture amongst the slaves, they had a more cultural affinity to the French. So when the French are realizing that the Spaniards are here helping the Africans to defeat them, so they're going to lose this island, they're like, we can't afford to lose this place. This is too expensive. This is too valuable. The French come in and say, listen, for you Africans, we will free you if you agree to help us fight the Spanish and get them out of here. So the Africans were like, oh, great, we can be French now. This is awesome. And they basically, this is under Toussaint Louverture, they're like, okay, we'll now fight for the French. We'll turn our back on the Spaniards and we will fight and kick the Spaniards out. The Africans, under the guise of the French, fight the Spaniards, boom, they kick the Spaniards out. So now the Africans are like, oh, great, okay, now the French are going to, you know, basically treat us fair, everything's gonna be great. Well, guess what happens in Rome? The British, who are like, all right, those Spanish are nothing, but the French are still weak. We want to come in and put these Africans back in shackles because we hate these French and we can take the whole island. You know, we can make it ours. So the British come in, they send their biggest export of ships. They send like 50,000 troops to the island, and they're like, We're gonna wax these Negroes, and we're gonna take this place, and we're gonna have it for ourselves, and the French will be done. They came to the island. 10,000 British soldiers died in 2 months.
Wow!
That's slaughtered. This was under Toussaint Louverture. As a matter of fact, if you read a book, there's a book called by a guy named David Geggis, and there was a story in newspapers in London. It was said that the British losses in the Haitian Revolution were so bad that there was not a single British person who didn't have someone in their family who experienced a loss in the Haitian campaigns. So, okay. The British take off. The Spanish are out. Bang. The British are out. Bang. So now the French are like, okay, Toussaint Louverture is governor general of the island. He's running the island. And they say, okay, listen, you can free the Creole black. This is very important. This is something that's very important, crucial detail that many people don't understand about the Haitian Revolution. There are three classes of black people in Haiti. One is pejoratively called the Bosal. You'd probably spell that B-O-S-S-A-L. The Bosal were Africans that were born in Africa that were transplanted to the island. So in other words, they obviously would be a little bit more rebellious, less acculturated to French culture, and they would be used to being free. The next are the Creole blacks. Creole blacks are blacks who were born on the island, but were not born in Africa. So they were more acculturated to the French system. They spoke better French. They had higher class standing than the Bosal Africans, but they were still blacks. Some of them were slaves. Some of them were free. And the blacks who were free sometimes owned slaves. Guess what? Toussaint Louverture, before the Haitian Revolution, actually owned black slaves. It shocks a lot of people. And then you had the Creoles who were mulatto, who were biracial or biracial adjacent in their opinions, who were also often free, but, you know, hated the blacks, wanted to be French, and owned 25% of the black slaves. So not only do you have white people owning slaves in Saint-Domingue, pre-revolutionary Haiti, you have Creole blacks, and you have Creole mulattoes who own slaves, a lot of them as well. This causes a situation where the blacks, the Creole blacks kind of hate the mulattoes because they think they're better than them because their skin is light and they're more white, so they hate each other. Creole mulattoes hate the Creole blacks, even though they're close in class standing because they're black and they like they don't want to be black. And the African Bosal hate them both because they oppress both of them. And the Creole blacks and mulattoes hate the Bosal because they're the lower rung on the totem pole and they're considered, you know, savages, Africans, so on and so forth. This class division plagues Haitian society to this day.
So, I want to return to that a little bit. I mean, in terms of like what were those factors? Well, I guess maybe now is the best time to address that part of it. Are those factors just driven? I mean, by both just race and culture? I mean, were they in
race, class, culture, capital, status? You know, all of those things, all of those great things that dialectical materialists tell you to study if you study some Marx.
Right. All right, and so. When,
by the way, the best part is this is a good part because we got out. They kicked out the British. They kicked out the French. They kicked out the Spanish. You're like, well, what happens with the French? What happens is with the French is that Napoleon takes power in France, right? And Napoleon is like, I have no tolerance for any of these Negroes. I want all these guys with their epaulets on their shoulders to be ripped off, put them all in shackles or exterminate them. I want them gone. I don't want to hear anything about no Toussaint Louverture running anything or any Negroes owning slaves. So Napoleon sends, you know, squadrons, dragoons of squadrons to the island to basically shut this whole game down. Toussaint Louverture is kind of like worried about all the French are coming. Don't forget, Toussaint Louverture up in this time never fought the French army with his own body. He fought the English and he fought the Spanish, but he had not fought the French. Well, Toussaint is a little kind of hesitant back and forth, and his second in command, Dessalines, is like, listen, man, we got to take it to these French because, you know, this is not going to be a good thing. Toussaint Louverture is eventually captured by the French, sent back to France, put in a prison, and dies begging Napoleon to be sent back to Haiti to be his governor general again. Napoleon Bonaparte dies saying his biggest mistake was not allowing Toussaint Louverture to come back. Dessalines, who hated the French, despised them, because there's another little class division between Toussaint Louverture and Dessalines. Toussaint Louverture is what you call an ancien libre or an old freed. What does that mean? When the Haitian Revolution starts in 1791, Toussaint Louverture had been a free man of color for about 20 years. So he knew freedom. He owned slaves. He owned property. Dessalines, though he was a Creole like Toussaint Louverture, was a nouveau libre. He was newly freed because of the revolution that started in 1791, and he was a brutally beat slave until 1791. So he had, even though he was not a Bosal or an African brought to the island, he had approximate identification with them because because he was just as brutally treated, even though he was a Creole, but he was only freed by the happenstance of the beginning of the Haitian Revolution. So there was a major divergent class worldview amongst these two men who were both Black, who were both born on the island, but because of the difference in times in which they were freed proximate to the beginning of the revolution and their relationship with the French and the empires that they fought with, they had two totally different worldviews of both French, Europeans, and white people.
And relative to the United States, and basically I want to just bring this back to a comment that Brian Concannon, who I think you know, was talking about the other day on the program, was as to why the United States has been consistently intervening and manipulating Haiti. I mean, in terms of like sheer dollars, Concannon was like, it's not necessarily, he doesn't think it's just necessarily resources. It's about the potential for Haiti to provide a model.
Yeah, it's the fear of a positive model.
And indeed, that was the concern, the American concern with the Haitian Revolution, was that this is going to provide some type of paradigm or blueprint or model or inspiration for American slaves.
For Black liberation.
And Black, yes. black liberation in the United States.
Right.
That's correct. Not only that, well, let me get finished on how this, what happens is that Toussaint Louverture goes, dies in the jail. Dessalines takes over the soldiers, the Haitian soldiers. Toussaint Louverture's capture inspires them to get more aggressive. Dessalines, who was rather brutal himself, says, we're going to massacre these French, and he totally defeats the French army. They are completely defeated, and they go back in shame, and they surrender to the country in a battle called Vertier that happens in November of 1803. And in the January of 1804, the next year, Dessalines, as the president and leader of the country, declares Haiti, and he changes the name from Saint-Domingue back to this original Arawak name and calls it Haiti, which the long name is Haiti Keskia Bohio, which is Haiti, the lands of mountains and valleys. But the thing that's interesting, as antagonistic as the United States has been to the Haitian Revolution and the Haitian people, there is no country that has been a bigger beneficiary of the Haitian Revolution than the United States. Because you know what happened and allowed the United States to recede as a result of the Haitian Revolution?
The slave trade getting bigger there.
No. The Louisiana Territory.
Right.
Why? Because Napoleon had sent 25,000 troops, which was actually larger than the U.S. Army, to New Orleans before he came to Haiti with a plan. He sent some troops to Haiti and some to New Orleans. His plan was like, after I beat these Africans in Haiti, I'm going to go to New Orleans and I'm going to conquer North America, and I'm going to make all these Yankees my French colonies. That was the plan. Because the Haitians were beating him so bad, he had to change the plan, take the army that he had in New Orleans, send them to Haiti, and they got waxed as well. And his plan to actually take over North America was vanquished. And because he got beat so bad to finance his losses, he sold all of the Louisiana Territory, which doubled the size of the United States, to Thomas Jefferson for less than 8 cents an acre. Which made the United States the country that it is to this day. Not only do we not only did the United States get the land that made the country, Haiti literally protected the United States from becoming a French colony.
All right. So that was pretty comprehensive wrap up of history in a relatively short period of time. So let's go to present day. I mean, if we know that the U.S. foreign policy establishment has viewed Haiti as a threat insofar as it could provide a model for the rest of you know, Latin America, Central America, it could just simply
provide global South, the Black world, the colonized world.
Exactly. And so give us a sense of like what your sense is of what happened. I mean, in terms of this assassination, let's take it to present day.
Oh, well, first of all, what happens in the 20th century is the United States occupies Haiti from 1915 to 1934, literally takes all the gold out of the Haitian coffers, sends it to Citibank, violently and brutally abuses the Haitian people. It controls the economy there for almost like 20 some odd years. And Haiti basically since 1984 has never had any real sovereignty over its government. Any president that was president of Haiti, if he even altered or deviated from the United States agenda, was either given a coup like Estime was in 1850 or possibly threatened with assassination. And if he wasn't, he was a complete tool and puppet of the United States, like Papa Doc was, Francois Duhayer. Why was Papa Doc such a valuable tool? Because he was anti-communist in the age of Fidel Castro. And so he was perfect. Use your charade of black nationalism to be anti-communist and the U.S. will support you. We got no problems. Just make sure you don't have any Haitian commies like my uncles in your country and get rid of them. Okay, so the Duvalier regime is very valuable. Guess why the Duvalier regime is kicked out in 86? Because what's happening in 86? The Soviet Union is falling apart. The fear of communism is no longer. We don't need the Duvalier regime anymore. Goodbye. Get out.
And so, so take us up to today.
So what happens today? The next regime that was actually the first democratically elected regime, which was somewhat radical because it was actually caring about poor people, was Jean-Bertrand Aristide. Jean-Bertrand Aristide was a priest who was into liberation theology. I think that's the closest thing you can get to Marxism as a Catholic. And he wanted to do massive wealth transformation, increase the minimum wage, and do something for the Haitian poor, who were the descendants of those African Bosals that both the Creole blacks and mulattoes looked down on and frankly didn't care about, and who made up the supermajority of Haitians and the majority of the Haitians who are poor. And he realized that this class setup is horrible, and there's a Haitian oligarchy, which is made up of people who aren't even organically Haitian. Most of them are Syrian, Lebanese, Arabs, Europeans who came to Haiti in the early 20th century, started businesses, and started getting major business concessions under the U.S. occupation and during the presidency of Duvalier, because they supported Duvalier against the mulattoes who Duvalier hated, or the biracial or the fair complexion Haitians. And they control literally 90% of the economy in Haiti today. That's a very important factor. The Haitian oligarchy becomes a proxy for the State Department in Haiti, in that whenever a coup is needed in Haiti, it's usually organized and orchestrated by the Haitian oligarchy with the support of the U.S. State Department. We have emails of one of the Haitian oligarchs going back and forth with Clinton aides, planning elections and things of that nature. So they are what Franz Fanon would call the neocolonial bourgeoisie in Haiti. But they're not Haitian, and they actually don't even look black. They actually look like Arabs, Syrians, and Europeans.
But Moïse was definitely in that tradition, right? I mean, he was part of the... Okay. Yeah.
This is a little complicated, right?
Right.
PHTK, PHTK, which was his party, which is the Parti Tekkale, which is they call it the Ballhead Party, because Michel Martelly, who was a pawn of the U.S., who was put in to govern over the earthquake so the Clintons could extract as much money as they could after during the earthquake rebuilding, started a party called PHTK. He was president during the Haiti earthquake rebuilding, did minor rebuilding of the country, did some things that he could. But what happened is during the rebuilding, in 2010, we had the Haiti earthquake, massive devastation. We all know about it. Massive amounts of international money are flowing into the country for development, right? Cash is everywhere, even though none of it is going to the Haitian poor.
Right.
What this exposes to people like Martelly is that we don't have to be dependent on the Haitian oligarchy, because they always extort money from the government because they're parasites. We can actually deal with international actors, get development deals done, like building roads and hospitals, for a cheaper price than the oligarchies, even though it's still under neoliberalism. Because these oligarchs are such crooks, we can actually cut better deals with international actors than the oligarchs. That's when that seed is first planted in the head of the PHTK party, that we can cut the oligarchs out and deal with international actors. Martelly's term is up, and he hand taps a guy who comes from the peasant lower classes. No one knew who this guy was. His name was Jovenel Moïse, and they basically say, this is going to be my replacement. The U.S. okays an election, which was totally fraudulent and totally illegitimate. Moïse becomes president. Because the country is forced into austerity because of a certain oil relationship with Venezuela that goes bad through the quote-unquote Petro-Caribe economic consignment that Venezuela gave to Haiti and Haitian oil, because Haiti oil prices go up and Venezuelan oil can't be used anymore. The IMF puts sanctions on, tells Haiti, you guys got to double your oil prices. And that's the beginning of the problems for Moise. And the country basically goes into austerity. Much of the reason why Moise has such a crappy administration is because the loss of the Venezuelan concessions forces energy prices to be so high in Haiti that the country is forced into austerity. He has to cut services, and poor people are suffering, and they're pissed, and they're trying to rebel. They're like, yo, you're not helping us out here. At the same time, because Moise is under that PHTK plan of cutting out the oligarchs, he is, when he gets into the administration, he's given four contracts, like 25-year contracts, that's supposed to go to the oligarchs. One is to control all the ports, which means you control all the trade. One is to control who imports the oil. One is to control who controls the electricity for like 25 years. And I think another one is who develops the roads in the country. All of these contracts are exploitative as hell. They would cost like twice as much as if the state did the planning itself. But because the oligarchs have such a parasitic control of the country, they were given these contracts by the prior prime minister, I think he got him, Juscelin Prévert, before Jovenel Moïse becomes president. Even though Jovenel Moïse was initially supported by one of the major oligarch families, at a certain point, in line with the PHTK is a kind of neo-devaluerist party in which they believe that they're going to bring back the renaissance of a black political class in Haiti to displace the kind of the oligarchs who both even the mulatto and the black middle class kind of despise. All right, they've actually become, the oligarchs became the top of the food chain. They displaced even the mulatto or fair complexion Haitians and even the black elites, and they were at the top of the food chain, and both those middle class Haitians despised them. So there was a belief that PHTK was going to be a revival of this kind of like Duvalierist kind of like multicolored middle class kind of shtick. I didn't buy it. I thought they were ultimately neoliberal anyway. But the larger point is that Moise, under the plan of like, okay, let's try to find a way to undercut the oligarchs, he decides at a certain point in his administration to throw those contracts in the trash. And that's when the real beef between him and certain factions of the oligarchy start getting hot. They start financing gangs. He starts financing his own reprisals. Poor people are dying left and right. He's having some of the oligarchs' businesses burnt up and destroyed. And there's basically an internal war going on between Moise and the oligarchs. But because Moise is okay in the eyes of the U.S., why? Because Moise stabbed Venezuela in the back after those oil concessions and said, I don't support Nicolas Maduro and I support Juan Guaido. So I have no problem with Guaido, and whatever the U.S. says is fine. He aligns himself with Trump. He's Trump's boy. Because Biden still hates Venezuela and has no problem with Moise's stabbing Venezuela in the back, Biden decides, okay, he can be our boy too. He's not a problem. Okay, we don't care what he's doing with the oligarchs as long as he helps us squash Venezuela. So he was valuable to the U.S. because he was a bulwark against the pink tide in South America and Latin America. What happens is that the beef between the oligarchs and Moise gets so hot because Moise is signing contracts. I posted a post on my Twitter. His last trip, he did a trip last month when he went to Turkey, and he had memorandums of understanding with the Turkish government to do development deals in Haiti. So not only did he throw out the contracts that the oligarchy was promised, he's cutting major deals to have all of the tasks that they were going to do done by international actors. Okay, so this all comes to a head, and someone has him whacked. If you ask me who I did it, I think it was done by the oligarchy with the green light of the United States, because I think the United States said, listen, this guy is too much of a problem. There's too much chaos. If you guys can guarantee a transition to a new administration that's friendly to both the United States and you guys, the oligarchs, since the oligarchs are always in the State Department's pocket, you guys can go with it. That's my theory.
That sounds pretty strong. I mean, there's a quality. It sounds like when it's a question of Moise and or the oligarchs, it's the United States sort of feels like heads we win, tails we also win, because we've got, these are the two, we've got Coke and Pepsi fighting it out, and at the end of the day, we're still going to have our cola, I guess. And the the idea at that point, we just apparently Jen Psaki has said that the Biden administration calls for free and fair elections in Haiti. It stands ready to receive a formal request for assistance if it comes.
Oh, so there you go. Now we're going to have the U.S. talking about we're going to come on down. That's the last thing they need. He's ready to rock and roll. It's going to be Clinton Obama 2.0.
So do you anticipate, I mean, who is there, as you look at the landscape in Haiti right now, is there an opportunity for who do you perceive, if anybody, within the government or within Haitian society who represents a possibility for an actual sort of like advancement of democracy?
I think, listen, I had Daoud André, who's a very well-known Haitian radical activist from Brooklyn, on our show. And he said, there is no one who is trustworthy in Haitian civil society. The only thing that can save this country is Haitian Revolution 2.0.
And what would that look like at that point? Like,
that would look like major, 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 major attacks on the oligarchs, because they're the tip of the problem, and a decision by the black middle class and fair complexion middle class with as to who they're going to align with. Because don't forget, those middle class blacks and fair complexion mulattoes, they usually work for the oligarchs in their jobs.
Yeah,
they own the banks. They own all the institutions.
And so, in other
words, part of the problem is that this class
they've been pyramid co-opted.
Scheme,
yeah,
which is destroying the lives of 75% of the country, is supported by middle class Haitians like my own family.
Well, it's a bit of musical chairs, right? Because yeah, even if Moïse, he kind of became so problematic that he was the odd man out, and the oligarchs teamed up against him. I mean, he was incredibly wealthy, right? Made his fortune.
No, he was not. He had some corrupt. He was not like oligarch wealthy. He had some change.
Okay. Yeah. So, I mean, then revolution, how does that come to be? What kind of organizing
effort? Well, that's a good
question. Right. Yeah. Know? Right.
Yeah. Well, the United States does not want that.
In regards to the Haitian middle class who provides sort of the ballast, right? I mean, that is that they, it sounds like you perceive the Haitian middle class as being, the almost like the fulcrum of this situation.
Don't forget, a lot of the diaspora makes up the Haitian middle class, even in absentia.
And where? What about the Haitian diaspora? I mean, we have.
I wouldn't trust them to throw a tannin, because a lot of them supported the coup to get rid of Aristide, and many of them just want to go back to Haiti and live bougie middle class lives with Restavec peasant, servants that they can hang out with and sexually molest when they get a chance.
Oof. All right. You don't perceive that there is an opportunity?
I think that there's some of them that can be. I think that the hope for the country is actually in the younger diaspora, not my parents' generation. They're hopeless. The younger Haitian diaspora who's living in America realizes that all this class nonsense is idiocy. If they could really get an educational terrain and understanding the what's going on in the ground, they're old enough to have resources and education. I think there's a potential if they nullify the oligarchy, people who are like, I would say, 60 and younger or 50 and younger, I think that they could actually transform the country, but it could not be under a neoliberal capitalist paradigm.
Let me just ask you this too. To what extent does the cohort of Haitians who are here under temporary protected status, and they've been sort of like, they were like a football, I guess, in the context of like the end of the Trump administration, where do they stand? Like, I mean,
are people who are usually poor from the peasant class who are just, they're fleeing their country. So they're refugees. They're coming to America trying to make a better life for themselves. So they're typically trying to bounce between not getting caught out there by ICE and trying to, like, find some kind of menial job. They don't have really a say because they can't vote. They're not U.S. citizens. They can't lobby the government. But we have a Haitian misleadership class as well, with journalists at certain publications, Miami Herald and otherwise, Haitian elected officials who do the same, buck dancing, worthless dance that the black misleadership class does to the Democratic Party that usually works to the detriment of the Haitian people. So unfortunately, we are mimicking that charade within our own community.
And there's no power center in the context of this country. There's certainly no political party that is going to change.
No, because the Democrats have actually been more toxic in the relationship to Haiti than the Republicans in the last 20 years. Well, except for Bush, the father, because the Bushes the Aristide coup. So I got to make that one alteration.
I know you talked about the Clintons just in terms of the historical progression of Haiti, but also can you expand on what happened in the wake of the earthquake and how via the Clinton Foundation outside of power, there was a neoliberal project.
The Clintons use Haiti as their personal ATM machine.
Right.
That's what happened.
Yeah.
I mean, just go into that a little bit, because I don't know if people fully appreciate that.
Well, Hillary Clinton's brother, who died, had literal contracts with gold mining in Haiti. There was gold discovered in Haiti. He had personal contracts for gold mining concessions.
Which gives you a sense of, one would imagine that's probably a function of her role in the U.S. government, as opposed to... Rodham, I think is his name, was his... all right, well... And so what do you anticipate, like, what do you anticipate happening? I mean, it's sort of like a bleak, sort of near-term forecast.
Welcome to Haitian life.
There you go. How do you anticipate this going down? Like, what is there
I think the U.S. is going to send a UN, probably contingency like MINUSTAH that we had during the earthquake and after Aristide, that was horrendous, who brought cholera to the country because they literally poured feces into the Artibonite River and gave cholera to the Haitian people. It's either going to be a UN military kind of MINUSTAH-like embarkment, or it'll be the U.S., which will be a nightmare, because I think even America – I don't think the Biden administration – wants to take that on at this time,
right?
Because that's just too much of an 800-pound gorilla in an era where, you know, listen, don't forget, Trump appealed to the Haitians against Hillary Clinton. He came to little Haiti in Miami and said, they've done you wrong, I'll do you right. We could take a look at the number of Haitians that voted for Trump in 2016 and ask if they flipped the state in Florida.
Wow. So Biden certainly, I mean, I think the Biden administration wants to have as little, you know, anything but, you know, three alarm fire in terms of their foreign policy. I think that's what they're not interested in engaging. You know, it's like the same thing with Israel and Palestine. They have no interest to the extent that they can in engaging in any of this. I think they'd be happy to maintain the status quo. So I would imagine.
Well, they're going to maintain the status quo. The question is, can they orchestrate a sham election effective enough to put in a puppet that will do the bidding of both the oligarchs and the Biden administration?
Yeah. Well, yeah. I mean,
without the Haitian grassroots totally just setting the country on fire.
I guess we will see. And my guess is if they don't find that person, then we'll just get another round of this type of violence.
Or there's revolution, which is, you know, your calls for that. It fits nicely into the plug of your podcast. Yeah. Right, exactly.
Revolution podcast. Check it out at your relevant social media on YouTube, Tuesday nights, 9 p.m., Thursday night, 9 p.m. Also on Saturdays at noon. Also your relevant podcast apps, Apple Podcasts. This is Revolution Podcast with my great co-host, Jason Miles.
Yeah, we'll put a link to that. Well, we only have about 2.5 minutes left, and I wanted to get your take on Eric Adams as a former Queens native.
Make a Queens, baby.
But we only have about 2 minutes left. So I'm not sure that we have time to go into that. But
well, you're the one who asked me for 200 years of Haitian history, man. I mean,
I know. I'm glad I did, frankly. we'll have more time to talk about Eric Adams. He will not win the general election, I guess, until November anyways. So maybe we'll have you back on for a bite at that apple. Pascal Robert, the podcast is This is Revolution Podcast. And we will put a link to that at majority.fm and in all our descriptions. Thank you so much.
By the way, tonight we're having a show on Haiti with Dr. Paul McComb on This Is Revolution.
All right, great. Folks, just check that out. And now I feel like folks have at least a context and a basis to understand what's going on down there right now. I appreciate that. Thanks so much for coming on.
All right.
Thanks, Pascal. Right.
No We're going to take... It might take all the strength I got to get to where I want, but I know...
somehow I'm gonna get there. I wasn't looking when I just got caught between the truth and the light bulb. But finding out won't make me feel any better. Yeah, I know the clock is ticking, but the meds are gonna kick in. And my pilot light's shining bright. I get somewhere the choice is made, for the option where you don't get paid, for the road that bends before it finally breaks you. I guess somehow I lost my drive,